This is KEPW 97.3, Eugene Peaceworks Community Radio. Don't forget, February 5th, McNeil O'Reilly House, 7 p.m., Free Angela and All Political Prisoners. Talk is cheap. I'm your host, DJ Susti, on KEPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene, Oregon, Peaceworks Independent Community Radio. Also simulcast on KEPW.org. Sorry about the abrupt transition there. We're working on our promos because that's one of the main things we do here on Independent Radio is tell you about what is going on and what you can do in the community to make positive social change. All right, and speaking of which, what I'm going to play you is from Todd Boyle's audio from the video of Todd Boyle, the local videographer here that uploads on YouTube, and you can get this full video on Todd Boyle, searching for Todd Boyle YouTube. What it is Curtis Austin, a different kind of cat on the Black Panther Party. He's a associate professor of history here in Oregon at the University of Oregon. So this is from April 18th, 2019, Curtis Austin on the Black Panther Party. And so what I've cut off is we could go on and on about the atrocities that have been visited upon black people throughout history, especially from the United States. So that's what he talks about in the beginning of his talk, not to lower the importance of that, but in the interest of time, I cut that off, and now he's going to talk about the Black Panther Party. So let's get right to it. Curtis Austin, different kind of cat on the Black Panther Party, here on KEPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene, Oregon, Peaceworks Independent Community Radio, also simulcast on KEPW.org. Thanks for listening. Support independent media.
Black Panther Party comes on the scene in October of 1966 because of this brutality that I tried to set the backdrop for you with. It's October. So in the first 10 months of 1966, there are 10 murders of black people in the San Francisco Bay Area. 10 murders. So we're used to these days, we don't see them, but you know, maybe get one a year. To a year. Imagine 10 murders, all justifiable homicide. The youngest murdered individual, 11. The oldest, 82. All justifiable. And so they decided they needed to do something about this violence. And that's what they decided to do. They were going to defend and protect the black community. So they start this organization. They look at what the Lowndes County Freedom Organization was doing and decide they're going to be a political party, but a different kind of political party. And I just like to say, at this particular point, the Panthers aren't all that radical. They've been made out to be extremely radical. But if you just take a really quick look at their 10-point platform and program, which is their guiding document, the philosophy that guided them, tell me what's so radical about wanting to be free, number one. That makes you radical? I mean, you'd be all radicals and in jail. I'm imagining you want to be free. What's so radical, number two, if you want a job, you know? What's wrong with having a good job? Is that radical? What about not wanting to be exploited? What if I told you when you leave, you got to give me $1,000? You wouldn't want to do that, right? What if I made you do that? You might have a different kind of reaction, right? That is not a radical thing, wanting to not be exploited. What is radical about wanting decent housing? What's radical about wanting an adequate education? Can you tell me? It's a real question. It's not rhetorical. Is there something radical about that? Black men exempt from military service. Oh, well, why? I mean, okay, well, let's talk about all the things that were happening up to this point. You're going to join the military and go, at this point, to Vietnam, defend the Vietnamese and save their country for democracy. But if you're Clyde Kinnaird, there ain't that much democracy to be saving for people, right? Because you're not getting any in Jackson, Mississippi. You're certainly not getting any in Boston with the busing issue. So they asked themselves, why would we go 10,000 miles around the world to fight for an entity that's been killing us, that's been denying us civil liberties and human rights for time immemorial? I don't think that's a radical thing. And maybe in the Q&A, you can tell me why that's radical. Okay, so number eight, you want all black men in jails and prisons free. All right, not all of them, you know, but most of them, because at this point, people were being tried by all white juries who didn't understand the average person in the black community. Just imagine if white people got tried by all black people. Right? How many convictions? What's the conviction rate you think is going to be? It's going to be 100% conviction rate because of this crazy thing they've got us in, right? Same thing here. Most of the time, the jails are being filled up with black and brown people. That didn't just start happening in the 1980s. That's been going on since they decided that slavery was no longer legal. It started shortly after that. I won't beat this horse to death, but I'm really trying to say that because the Panthers dress a particular way, you know, these black uniforms or black berets or black boots, they carried weapons, which was completely lawful. I mean, for those of you who've been in Oregon a long time, what if somebody tried to tell you you can't carry your weapon, right? They'd have some trouble, wouldn't they? Well, in California, it was the same thing. You know, there was nothing illegal about carrying weapons. And so what they would do is watch the police. And how would they watch the police? They would follow them throughout their communities. They see a police car show up. They get in their cars, drive behind them until they stop somebody. They stop somebody. The law said you needed to be standing 25 feet away from a police officer carrying out his or her duties. They would stand 100 feet away and yell over, "Hey, brother, hey, sister, we're the Black Panther Party. We're just here to make sure that you don't get brutalized or beaten. And if you happen to get taken to jail, we'll come and bail you out." This goes on day in and day out in the Oakland black community. And the police don't like it, as you can imagine, right? And they, of course, yell at the Black Panthers, "Who do you think you are? You need to get out of here." But of course, nothing ever happens. And why doesn't anything happen? Because people are armed. They're not pointing their guns at anybody. They're just saying, "We're the Black Panther Party. We're here to make sure that nothing happens to you." Remember I told you 10 people died in the 10 months before the party was founded? Well, the party's founded in October 1967. From October 67 to November 67, you want to know how many people died? Yep, zero. You can't hear her, but she said it. No shootouts, no confrontations, no, zero. What does that say about the police? And they got tired of killing black people? Yeah. What's that? I think they felt checked. And you can see in this particular image, Bobby Seale and Bobby Hutton, actually the first member to join the party. Bobby Hutton was 15 when he joined the party. And by the way, the average member of the Black Panther Party was 19. So quite young. They're standing outside of the jail here where they have followed somebody down and they're bailing them out. And they got lots of recruits this way. And sometimes when they bail people out, they went back and told their friends and families. Those people joined the Black Panther Party. Well, eventually this thing is going to come to a head. The cops are so upset about this that they go to their local assembly person, Don Mulford, and say, you got to do something about these guys. You know, these black people following us with guns. Of course, they probably didn't say black people, you know. But you got to do something about them. And of course, Mulford's like, I got you. I'm going to go do that. And he goes right up to Sacramento, starts to write this bill, and all of a sudden, now there are rules against carrying guns. You know, this is the West, right? Can you imagine? Yeah, well, I mean, the NRA didn't say anything, but you got the wrong people carrying guns. And so what happens is the Panthers decide they're going to go and protest the passage of this new bill. The Mulford bill is going to be called the Mulford Act. And what they do is go up to Sacramento to view the discussion over this bill. And it's actually a room very much like this. Most of you can't see that door, but what happens is there's about 30 of them. They all get in their cars, leave Oakland, drive up to Sacramento. And the law said that you actually can't have loaded weapons inside your car. So they get to the state capitol in Sacramento, and they get out of their cars, and then they load their weapons. And so just imagine all these black people in black dress getting out of the car in front of the state house, loading their weapons. And right there to the side was Governor Ronald Reagan. He's talking to a group of 4-H students. He sees these black people get out of the cars, load their weapons. He takes off. Leaves the kids to fend for themselves. And we know all of this happens because he's all on videotape. The person who's videotaping Ronald Reagan actually starts videotaping the Panthers because Reagan is now gone. And so they hang out with the kids for a while, but then they wind up inside the state capitol. Of course, none of them have ever been to Sacramento, much less inside the capitol. And so they're immediately lost. And I mentioned the thing about this door here because they asked somebody, where's the viewing room? The viewing room is just like a gallery, like where you all are sitting out here today. And a reporter told them it's right there through that door. And they went through the door. And rather than that being the gallery, that was the assembly floor. So just imagine yourselves as lawmakers and all these black people, men and women, showing up on the assembly floor with a bunch of weapons. It probably wasn't fun. If you haven't seen my book, I encourage you to read at least one page. If you don't read the one page, read the one line. I wrote a book called Up Against the Wall, and the first line of that book, and I'm not going to say it because there are little people in the room. But the first line of that book is, who in the world are these Negroes with these guns? But he didn't say Negroes. He said something else. And, of course, the person who said that took off. He didn't wait for an answer because there were Negroes with guns on the floor. But what happens is all of this gets recorded. And Bobby Seale reads executive mandate number one. He's saying, you know, Vietnam is going on and things are going on in the South and things are going on in New York and Boston. All this activity is unfolding here. And it's mostly black people being brutalized, black people being murdered because they want to vote, because they want to integrate a school, because their house is nicer. There are actually laws on the books in Alabama, Mississippi, and Georgia that says you can't have a nicer house. I'm not exaggerating. You can go look this up, your students. There's a law in Mississippi that said that you can't pass a white person on the highway. So if a white person's driving 15 and a 25, you just got to wait. You can't go around them because it's illegal. Yes?
Is that still to this
No, that was 1927. Yeah, I pass them all the time. Yeah, no. Yeah, they can't catch me. But that was a good question. But what this does is goes throughout the state of California, then across the country. And overnight, this tiny organization goes from a handful of people, 25, 30 people, to thousands. People in New York, people in New Orleans, people in Boston, people in Wisconsin, people in Illinois say, I want to be a part of that organization. Because keep in mind now, this is May 1967. The Civil Rights Movement has been on the TV every night since Kennedy was elected in 1960. And most of what you see is people saying, there's no way we're going to win our rights, our human and civil rights, without using nonviolence. So you got people watching these news shows going, I want to help, but I ain't gonna let nobody spit on me or hit me in the head with a brick or push me and not push them back, right? And so you really had to be a very strong, courageous, disciplined human being to be involved in the nonviolent civil rights movement. Some people think that's a weak way to do that, but actually, I mean, how much courage does it take to be just strapped down with guns and then go into some crazy community, right? Like Cicero, if you're in Chicago. Or go in there barehanded, where they have all the bricks and the bottles and the Molotov cocktail. I mean, you're not a weak person for being a nonviolent civil rights activist. I can tell you that for sure. I've interviewed a lot of them. But in any case, this gave people an option. The folks who wanted to be a part of the movement now had something they can become a part of because they didn't feel like they were disciplined enough to turn the other cheek. They felt like if you turn the other cheek, you'll get it handed to you. And so when they saw the Black Panther Party on the news, they decided, well, let's go and take care of this. And there are a lot of myths about the Black Panther Party. There's a bunch of black men, like in this image, and all they want to do is go around and kill white people. They're racist, and they're looking to undo civilization, and they're going to do that by just shooting up the whole place and taking it over. Actually, nothing could be further from the truth. The fact of the matter is, by the time the organization was 3 years old, the majority of the people in the party were not men, they were women. By 1972, by the time the organization is 5 years old, the majority of the leadership is women. So it's not just a bunch of black men looking to kill white people. In fact, it was a bunch of black people looking to serve humanity. First, the black community, but humanity in general. The fact that the Black Panther Party remained as small as it did can be explained by them being anti-racist. Remember, I talked just a little bit about the Black Power movement. This was the big Afro time, the natural, you know, black is beautiful, black this and black that. And black people, for the most part, didn't want to have a lot to do with white people. The Panthers were like, that's actually not the best route to take. It's not white people. It's monopoly capitalism. That's the problem. A lot of people in the black community did not necessarily understand that. And so they were like, if you're going to be working with those white folks, and the Panthers were working with white folks, then I don't want to be a part of it. That's why the organization remained as small as it did. It had a bunch of signature programs. One of these programs was the breakfast program. What they learned is that students were not learning in school. And they found out students were not learning in school because they were hungry. And so they decided they would feed the children. The minute they did that, the minute these kids go to school, their grades skyrocket. It's really hard to figure out the square root of something if you're hungry, right? If you had English professors like me, you're going to diagram a sentence, but you hadn't eaten since yesterday. I mean, you want to do it, but you're thinking, what am I going to eat? Well, the Panthers worked to solve this problem, and I bring it up at this point because what they do is go around to the major grocery stores and ask them for food and donations. So if you had milk or juice or eggs or bacon or cereal or money. And you can imagine in the 1960s, the big grocery stores were owned by white people, right? And overwhelmingly, white people was like, okay, here you go. We'll give it to you. So if they were racist, anti-white, not to kill white folks, I doubt these grocers would have given them all the money to serve free breakfasts across the country to something like 20 to 25,000 people every day, right? This program was so successful that the FBI decided it was going to take it over. And by the time I'm a first grader, the federal government has its own free breakfast program, right, to keep people from going to the Black Panther Party's breakfast program, because not only do you get cereal and eggs and bacon, you got a little political education. Like, you got a little black history. There's a little lesson. You might sing a song, you know. And you don't want to raise people from that age, because you get somebody that's, you know, 7 or 8, and then they got 10 years of that. Probably going to be a different kind of student when they get to college. So it's best to give them your own breakfast. And so I will admit, a lot of days I went to school to eat because we didn't have food. I knew I was going to get that free breakfast. I knew I was going to get that free lunch. But I got it because they were trying to keep people from going to the Black Panther Party programs. Another signature program were their free health clinics. Of course, the black community had major health issues. I mean, they're poor, they're destitute, they're poverty-stricken. They live in homes that have lead in them, holes in the roof, rats and roaches and all other kinds of vermin that might make a person sick. Well, the Panthers realized that they couldn't pay for medical care. And so they brought them medical care. Well, the Panthers aren't doctors. Where would they get that from? Well, they went down to the local university. They found medical students. They found nurses. They found doctors and asked them, would you come to the black community and help us deal with some of these problems? Overwhelmingly, they said yes. Again, 2018, the overwhelming number of people in the nursing field, in the medical field, are white. And these people are funding and supplying the Black Panther Party free health clinics across the country. And so this idea that they are anti-white and racist, I just doubt that doctors and nurses and medical students would be okay with giving their time, their services to an entity that was out to kill them. I just doubt that. So by 1968, the Panthers are on an upsurge. And what we begin to see is they start to feel the heat from the federal government. The federal government start kicking in the doors of these programs, these breakfast programs, destroying the food, burning the cereal, taking the supplies, getting rid of the medical equipment, because they don't want to see them succeed. And most people are like, man, those Panthers, they're bad news. I'm not going to be dealing with that, you know. Maybe I need to go and join up with Martin Luther King, because by this time he's getting a little bit more radical too. You know, in 67 he gives that speech on Vietnam. He's going, you know what, I've been thinking, and maybe I could look at it a different way. Well, almost 1 year to the day after he started thinking differently, what happens to King? Like, no, you start talking about this economic stuff, you start saying that we're the greatest purveyor of violence on earth, then it's time for you to go. And that's what he did. He went. On April 4th, 1968, King is murdered in Memphis. And what this does to the Black Panther Party is quadruple its membership, because people are now saying, man, I was going to go with the radical King, but now King is dead. So who do I go with? Well, they begin to go in droves in the Black Panther Party after the murder of Martin Luther King. And these breakfast programs get new life. These free health clinics get new life. They have free clothing, free shoes, free dental. I mean, they have, at the end of the day, about 46 different free social service programs. And how do young, black, poor people do this, and the federal government that's got trillions of dollars cannot? That's going to be on the test. Think about that. So once they get this second breath of fresh air, what we start to see is the FBI starts to tighten the screws. And what they want to do is to make sure that the organization doesn't go any further than it's already gone. And so what it does is to come up with something called the Counterintelligence Program. Now, the fact of the matter is the Counterintelligence Program was invented in 1956 to address what was then known as the communist threat. It was retooled in the mid-60s to deal with black civil rights organizations like King's SCLC, like the NAACP, like the, of all organizations, the Congress of Racial Equality, the Urban League, all attacked and spied on by the FBI. But they really wanted to make sure that the Black Panther Party didn't grow and get other people interested. And so you can see here on the screen the kinds of things that they were trying to prevent the party from doing. I want to point you to the second check mark, that second bullet point, prevent the rise of a messiah. I just want you to know that this is not always an individual. The federal government also saw a messiah as organizations. So it wasn't just Martin Luther King or an A. Philip Randolph or a Huey Newton. It could be the NAACP if they got radical enough. It could be CORE if they got radical enough. It could be the Black Panther Party if it got radical enough. And so, I mean, how do you prevent the rise of an organization like that? You take them to court, you know? What do you do? They don't want the long-range growth. Look at that last one. They don't want the long-range growth of militant black nationalist organizations. And so they're going to do what they can to stop this organization. And what Hoover does in 1969 is label the organization as the greatest threat to the internal security of the United States. This labeling turned out to be the excuse sheriffs and their deputies, police officers, and other law enforcement officials across the country. That's the excuse they needed to take off the gloves with the Black Panther Party. The top law enforcement official in the United States has says they're a threat. And what do you do with threats, right? If I stop, you know, doing my thing here and start threatening you, you're going to get up and leave? Probably not. You're going to show me what for, right? Like, you're going to make me make good on those threats. Some of you might be pacifists and get up and leave, but most of you probably won't. So this is what happens. Now that the organization has been called a threat by the White House and the FBI, the gloves are off. And what do I mean by the gloves being off? The person who founded the Black Panther Party chapter in Los Angeles in January of 1969, this guy's name is Alprentice Bunchy Carter. He was a student at UCLA at the time. And by the way, Bobby Seale and Huey Newton were also students when they founded the organization, college students at Merritt College. Bunchy Carter was a student at UCLA. He was in a meeting discussing the founding of black studies at UCLA. The meeting turned boisterous, and members of the US organization, the guy sitting next to him is Maulana Ron Karanga, the leader of the US organization. You might know him as the founder of Kwanzaa. Didn't like the person they were choosing and didn't like him so much that they sent people from the US organization to kill Bunchy Carter. And we know this because those documents have been declassified today. We can read the FBI documents and they show that they had their hand in this. It's crystal clear. It's black and white. It's not redacted. You can go find this out for yourself. So he's killed along with John Huggins at UCLA, on the campus of UCLA in January of 1969. Again, the gloves are off. Same thing in Chicago. Mark Clark and Fred Hampton. Mark Clark is the defense captain in Peoria, Illinois. Fred Hampton is the Minister of Defense for the Illinois State Chapter, but based there in Chicago. Fred Hampton's 21 years old. He took his NAACP youth group in high school from about 40 members to 400 members. So he was a person well known in Chicago long before he joined the Black Panther Party. He made the party better and not the other way around. He was very good at convincing people that there was injustice in the United States. And not only that, he was very good at convincing people that they needed to address the injustice. And when I say people, I don't mean just the black people on the South Side or the black people on the West Side or the two black people on the North Side. I mean everybody who would listen to him. And so you've probably heard that Jesse Jackson created the Rainbow Coalition. Not true. It was Fred Hampton who brought together Latinx people. It was Fred Hampton who brought together Native American people. It's Fred Hampton who brought together poor white people, Puerto Rican people. A number of different ethnicities come together in Chicago to address the issues that are plaguing the black community, the white community, the Latino community, and so on and so forth. But the screws are being tightened. So on December 4th, 1969, the FBI authorizes this raid on Fred Hampton's apartment, and he's been drugged by a guy named William O'Neill. The FBI infiltrated William O'Neill into the organization. William O'Neill poured psilocybin into Fred Hampton's Kool-Aid. And based on the coroner's report that I've read, it's enough to kill an elephant. So at about 4 o'clock in the morning on December 4th, the police knock on Fred Hampton's door. Mark Clark answers the door, says, "Who is it?" And they say, "Tommy." He says, "Tommy who?" And they say, "Tommy Gunn." And they start spraying that apartment. They shoot Mark Clark directly through the heart. He's the first person to die. The only shot that the Panthers get off during this particular episode is a shot that Mark Clark lets off in his dying breath. He shoots the shotgun he's holding through the ceiling. The other 101 shots are all from police officers. And there are 8 people in that apartment that get shot up, including Harold Bell. Fred Hampton is in the bed while all of this is going on. Just imagine your bedroom being shot up 100 times and you don't know it because you've been drugged. Well, his fiance, who was 8 months pregnant, knew it. She was yelling and screaming, saying, you know, there are people in here, there's a baby in here, women in here. They didn't care. They just kept shooting. They corralled everybody into the kitchen, and they went back into Fred Hampton's bedroom. And we know that this dialogue took place because we can read the trial transcripts and see what the police said and see what the other people who were testifying said. And what they said is they heard them say, "That's Fred Hampton. Is he dead yet?" And the other police officer, Carmody was his name, said, "I don't know. Let's check." And the next thing they heard were 2 shots from a .45 automatic pistol to the back of Fred Hampton's head. And they heard the guy say, "He's good and dead now." And in fact, he was. They drug him out. And there's the end of Fred Hampton. And eventually, the Black Panther Party in Chicago is going to limp along for several years. But nobody was able to replace the kind of dynamism and magnetism and organizational ability that Fred Hampton had. They didn't come in there to arrest him. He wasn't accused of anything. They don't even make up like he had stole something or, you know, spit on the sidewalk. They just went in and killed him. So the Panthers start to go, "Wait a minute, you know, you're killing all of our people." There are also just thousands and thousands of arrests across the country. The Panthers have this newspaper. People stand out in the street and sell it for a quarter. Individual keeps a dime. The party gets 15 cents. That's how people make money. It doesn't sound like much to you, but in 1968, I mean, I don't want to say too much about my age, but when I was a kid, a Coke cost 10 cents. Can you believe that? You think you can get a Coca-Cola today for 10 cents? No, you cannot. A bag of potato chips when I was a kid was 15 cents. I was in 7-Eleven the other night. Why is a bag of potato chips, it's not even good for you. Anyway, they're saying, wait a minute, we need to do something about the situation. You can see how happy the cops are after they killed Fred Hampton. So the Panthers decide they need to do better about defending themselves. After all, their original name was the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. And so they started to fortify their offices as a result, putting up sandbags, putting chicken wire in the windows in case somebody tried to throw tear gas inside. And so they're just going around the country, the police and the FBI, going around the country looking for Panther leaders to kill. Those they can't incarcerate, they want to kill. So they show up 4 days after the murder of Fred Hampton in Los Angeles. All of us have heard of SWAT, right? Special Weapons and Tactics. Well, there was no SWAT before the Black Panther Party. The Los Angeles Police Department realized that it was going to be difficult to deal with the party. So they needed a special unit to do this dealing. And they decided to test SWAT out on December 8th, 1969. And that's what they do. They show up at 41st and Central, Black Panther Party headquarters. And they don't even knock this time. They just kick the door open. But here's what happens. It's 4 in the morning. The Panthers have a 15-year-old kid on the roof as security, right? And this kid hears dogs barking. It's 4 o'clock in the morning. What in the world are all these dogs? I mean, there's dogs barking all over the neighborhood. And so that kind of wakes him up. He starts to look around. First thing he sees are people in these black suits crawling up on the roof to where he is. And he got the opportunity. Like, all he needed was a couple of seconds. The sign was to stomp on the roof if something was happening, right? And he was able to do that before they grabbed him, threw him on his head, and injured his neck. Till this day, his neck is not right. But the people heard him stomp on the roof, and they all woke up. And so when the SWAT team rushed through the door with their Tommy guns, automatic weapons, not semi-automatic, we're talking fully automatic weapons that people are using in Vietnam, they're spraying the place. Well, Gil, the 15-year-old on the roof, has given the signal. And Mevin Cotton Smith heard the signal. Well, some kind of way, he had a machine gun too. And so he starts shooting back at the cops. And we know what the cops said because there was a trial afterwards. And what the cops said was, they're shooting back. They're shooting back. Get out, you know. And that was a big deal because usually they catch you sleeping. Like they caught Fred, right? Or they catch you slipping. Like they caught Bunchy Carter. And so many others I wasn't able to name for you. But these Panthers shot back. And 4 hours later, they were still shooting back. They actually had reinforced the roof with steel plates. So when the LAPD dropped bombs on the roof, it didn't do anything. Well, at the end of 4 hours, you're in a little apartment in downtown Los Angeles. How many bullets do you have, right, after 4 hours? Even if you got 1,000 rounds. And you've been shooting at the SWAT team and they're shooting back, you're going to run out. And so there's this discussion about, man, what are we going to do? And everybody in the apartment is saying, in the office is saying, I'm not surrendering, you know. We've been shooting at the police. And they're going to do something to us if we try to surrender. And I like this part of the story because there are two women in there and they just say, y'all some wusses. You know, what do you mean you're not going to say, I'll go out there? It's like, I wouldn't recommend that, you know. She's like, this sister, her name's Samaya Moore. They called her Peaches. She's like, give me that shirt. She takes one of the guy's T-shirts, walks out the door, waves it. And guess what? The police don't do anything because they don't like being shot at either. They're tired of being shot at, too. They are relieved that people want to surrender. And what happens after that is the rest of them come out. They're being arrested. It's like, whew, man. If you read the history of SWAT, this is a good story. They wore a badge on their uniform for a long time that said 41st and Central 69 because they remembered, you know, you really need to be ready if you're going to go do that kind of thing, right? But in any case, all these people, something like 12, 13 people wind up being arrested. And guess what happens? They get found not guilty. Why do they get found not guilty? Because the Black Panthers decide they want a jury of their peers. Remember the 10-point program? So the voir dire takes almost a year. And they insist on people knowing about them and their communities. And so they get some Hispanic people on the jury. They get some Asian people on the community. They get two black people. They're both bankers, but hey, what are you going to do? They're black on the jury. And the jury finds them all not guilty because the police admitted to shooting. And guess what? In this country, it's not illegal to defend yourself. So yeah, this guy is the person responsible for the fortification of not just the Los Angeles office, but offices all across the country. His name is Geronimo Pratt. He was also sent to prison for 27 years for something the police know he didn't do. They said that he killed a school teacher in Santa Monica. And they know he didn't kill the school teacher because on the day the school teacher was killed, they had the Black Panther Party headquarters bugged, and Geronimo Pratt was actually in a meeting in Oakland in the Black Panther Party headquarters being recorded and not in Santa Monica killing a school teacher. But because they needed to do whatever they needed to do to get him off the streets, because they came to the realization that he's the one that's helping them to defend themselves, they need to get rid of him. Well, why was he so special? Well, he leaves Louisiana, goes to Vietnam twice, becomes a demolition specialist, winds up in the Dominican Republic. See, you probably know about Vietnam, but during this particular time period, there are people fighting in Mozambique and Zimbabwe and the Dominican Republic. There are people of color all over the world in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, and into the early 1980s who are fighting for their freedom. Some of them are marching and signing petitions, but some of them are actually out there fighting, shooting, throwing rocks, whatever they have to fight with. And Geronimo Pratt had been in the military and was very well versed in military tactics. And he taught a lot of the Panthers those military tactics. And so he was able to hook up with one of the main figures of the organization and take over what eventually becomes known as the underground wing of the Black Panther Party. So the people serving the breakfast, the people working the health clinics, the people selling the newspapers, the people registering people to vote, that's above ground. Now they're saying the police, by way of the FBI, is looking to kill members of the Black Panther Party. So we can either stand here and be killed, or we can run and hide. You can live to fight another day. And so an underground starts to develop in the organization. That underground becomes known as the Black Liberation Army. Now, Black Liberation Army is also a type of concept. There are scholars, political scientists, historians who insist that the Black Liberation Army has been around since the first slave stepped off the first slave ship. There are instances in the 1520s, as an example, in Georgia, where African people who have been enslaved leave the ship, literally go into the swamps of Georgia, hook up with what becomes known as the Seminole Indians, and push the Spanish out of Georgia. You know about the Spanish in Florida, right? Well, they were in Georgia too, until some people in what some scholars call the early Black Liberation Army decided they were going to fight to push them out. And so while there is this defensive posture because these screws are being tightened, the underground starts to employ an offensive strategy as well. And they don't do it willy-nilly. See, I showed that image of the four little girls because I knew it would resonate with you and I knew that you had seen it before. And I showed that image of Emmett Till because I knew it would resonate with you. I showed that image of Trayvon Martin because I knew you had a sense of what that history was like, even though it's not that long ago. During this particular time, it was commonplace for police officers to kill 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15-year-olds in the black community, and nothing happens. So in this one particular case, we get two police officers who throw a child, a 14-year-old, off the top of a 60-story building because they think he's stolen something, catch him on top of the building, throw him off. Now, you know you're not going to land on your feet if somebody throws you off a 60-story building, right? Kill him. Now, even if he did steal something, which we don't know, he's dead, right? He didn't get a chance to go to court. The penalty after you're convicted of stealing is not death, right? It's not even jail, depending on where you go to court. It's you pay for what you stole or probation or I don't know. You know, I never got caught stealing. You know. But it's not, you don't get killed for it, right? Well, like I said, it's not willy-nilly. So they find the people who are involved in these types of dastardly acts, and they go and have a little payback. And here's an example where you see two members of the New York Police Department who have been involved in the kind of action I'm talking about that then have to answer to the Black Liberation Army. In their view, they're at war. In their view, they're defending the Black community. In their view, they're defending themselves from what they know is coming. Fred Hampton was asleep, remember? Again, not accused of anything. Nobody even insinuated he had done anything. So it's not like you have to have done anything to be killed. You just got to be. So they decided they were going to start assassinating police officers, and that's exactly what they did. Another example, they say that members of the Black Liberation Army called the police, and they knew what police were coming because these police were going through the Black community causing all kinds of havoc. And so sure enough, they get sent on this domestic battery call, and at the domestic battery call, they walk back to their cars, and people walk up behind them and kill them. That's in 1971. Now, I know you're thinking that's bad. That's horrible. How can they possibly do something like that? Right? I know that's what you're thinking. That's not a good thing. Come on. These are first responders. These are the people who protect us. I mean, I know if somebody breaks into my house, I'm going to call the police, right? These are people that help us. Like, why are you doing that? Well, unless you lived through this particular period and you saw your brother, your son, your cousin, your neighbor be thrown off a building for no reason, it doesn't make sense to you, right? Unless you're the mother of Emmett Till, who you know didn't do what they said he did, then it won't make a lot of sense to you unless you have lived in the kind of situation that prevents you from working, that prevents you from being healthy, that prevents you from having a home that is adequate, you know, that won't make you sick, then it's going to be very difficult for you to understand how something as extreme, and I admit it's quite extreme, as this can be okay to the men and women in what's called the Black Liberation Army. But we all think of Hamilton and Washington and Thomas Paine, the great patriots, you know, who fought their revolution against the British. They killed a bunch of British people, right? And I'm sure the British thought that that was not good. But how many of us think that that was not good? We think that was fine, don't we? They needed to get out of here. They were taxing us without representing us. We don't want to pay those taxes and not get nothing from it. Who wants to do that? Well, that's a good idea to kill people if they do something like that to you. And that's what the American patriots decided they were going to do. And if we look at the French Revolution, don't we hold that up as something that's good? The storming of the Bastille? Do we not do that? All kinds of movies about the French Revolution. Look at the Chinese Revolution. Yeah, it was great, the Cultural Revolution that went on. Well, these individuals thought that they were part of a revolution too. They thought that they were defending their community and their lives too. And this is the type of work they did. So how did they maintain secrecy? Well, they had a bunch of white friends. And as a matter of fact, some of their white friends live right up the road. If you want to get out of sight in the 1960s and 70s, one of the places you could go is Footbridge Farm, not far from Eugene, Oregon. Because there are a bunch of white people that are just cool with them. They understand that you need to do what you have to do, and we'll feed and clothe and supply and hide you. And again, it's why the organization is so small to begin with, because you have a lot of black people who don't see, well, I want to go and make an alliance with some white folks. You know, they don't. Well, actually, you don't really understand human nature if you believe that. If you sit down and talk to people, you'll find that you have far more in common than you have that's different. Like, if you just base it on this, you're never going to get anywhere. On skin tone, you're never going to get anywhere. All you got to do is look at the black community, right? And light-skinned people, they get all the props. People like me, I mean, so you see what I'm saying? If you just base it off skin color, you're going to be spinning your wheels for centuries. But if you base it off principle, what you'll find is the overwhelming majority of human beings are not the way you think they are, no matter what color they are. Now, that's not to say that whites in general don't benefit from racism, don't benefit more than most people from capitalism. At the end of the day, it's not their fault. They didn't decide who they were going to be born to, just like you didn't decide it. All right? And so we have to get out of our seats, walk across the aisle, talk to people, find out what's going on. If we want to solve a problem, work with folks who want to solve that problem, not with folks that only look like you. Because I can tell you a lot of people that look like me, I don't want to work with, and some of them I'm kin to, right? No, I do. I've got some brothers that you remember that thing about letting people out of jail? I know some people need to be in jail. You know, and I don't want them doing anything for me or with me. So in any case, this situation became really problematic because the FBI didn't know what to do. The Panthers had money, they had places to go, and they had the backing, not just of people like me, you know, in the low, low middle class, but really rich white people. J. Edgar Hoover called them credit card revolutionaries, right? They were getting them false ID. They were sending them to Europe and Asia. They were buying them houses and cars and guns and everything. And they were out there shooting with them. And so I think I'm getting down to the time where I need to stop, so I'm going to wrap this up. But I'll give you just one example of these black and white people working together and folks trying to show that if you just fight back, people will back off you. And this incident takes place in 1971 in San Francisco, where, again, police officers have been running roughshod over the black community, particularly down in the Fillmore and in the Hunters Point Bayview area. They've killed numerous children, 12-year-old, 13-year-old, 15-year-old, all justifiable. And so somebody decides they're going to respond to that. And they go down to the local police station. Well, they pile into these cars. They go down to the police station. They sneak through the woods. And they're getting ready to do something bold. But they got to wait for the signal. And the signal is the bombing of the Bank of America. So at about 9:20 on this night, the Stonestown branch of the Bank of America is bombed. That almost empties the Ingleside police station because, of course, you know, building's been bombed. It's not just any building. It's the Bank of America. We need to go check it out, right? And some white people bombed that building, all right? Some really rich white people bombed that building. And then you had people who went up into the Ingleside police station and started shooting. Now, luckily and fortunately, the individuals who stayed behind were behind this doubly reinforced steel door that these people couldn't shoot through. And when they realized they couldn't shoot through it, they stuck a shotgun through the speaking hole where people did business. You know, you pay your ticket or, you know, maybe you buy a license tag or something. I don't know what you buy at the police station, but you can get all kinds of stuff at the police station. They stuck a gun through that hole and pulled the trigger. And that killed Sergeant John Young. And there's the Ingleside police station. They leave Ingleside. You can see the diagram there that the police have put together. And they disappear. That's the end of it. John Young is no more. And the very next day, they decide they're going to send the San Francisco Chronicle, the local newspaper, a letter. And that letter says, "Message to black people. On the night of August 29, 1971, revolutionary violence was committed against the Ingleside pigsty as one political consequence for the recent intolerable political assassination of Comrade George Jackson in particular and the inhumane torture of inmates and prisoner of war camps in general." Panthers were being sent to jail and tortured is what they're referring to. We retaliate against these acts along with the constant murder and brutality of black people in their communities. We must not forget nor allow our oppressors to continue brutalizing our families and friends of our incarcerated comrades, signed by the George L. Jackson Assault Squad of the Black Liberation Army. So in case you were wondering who did this, we did it, is what they're saying. And the police actually are going to wind up spending about four decades and several million dollars looking for the people who did this. They never found them. But what they did do was hire their own security guards. Can you imagine that? The police hired security guards. Because the police are really not trained and equipped in 1971 to deal with the kind of threat they're facing. Today, I would not recommend that for you. They're very trained. They're very equipped. Let's sign a petition. Let's take some black studies classes. You know, let's do something different. Right? I don't think that's going to work. It's probably not a good idea. But in 1971, they felt like it was enough to make them see, this is what you're doing to us. This is the extent that you've pushed us through. Like, is it worth all of that? They are basically saying if there's going to be crying and wailing in the black household, there's going to be some crying and wailing in the white household. Now, for you Christians, you've heard of the I-49, the 242. All right? That makes sense to you. But I like what Gandhi and King said. If we go by that, all of us are going to be blind and toothless. I appreciate his analysis of that, right? So a few days later in Los Angeles, the police think they've found the people who committed this atrocity. And they follow these people around the streets of Los Angeles. And they eventually get them to pull over. And when they pull over, a thing like this happens. And I got this from the trial transcripts as well. One police officer, actually a guy named Officer Kapelkoff, gets out of a police car, walks up to the back of the car, and points his pistol inside the back seat. It says, "Put your hand on the seat. Put your hands on the seat." And he's saying a lot of other words that I don't want to say because the, you know, young people are in here, but it's MFs, a lot of that is going on. And the guy he's talking to sees him, you know, he just said he felt like the guy was going to shoot him. And sure enough, he shoots him. And when he shoots him, this guy shoots back. And when he shoots back, there's this shootout. There are 200 bullet holes in the car they were riding in. But the guy on the back seat, the guy driving, and the guy in the front seat decided they're going to shoot back. And they shot back until they ran out of bullets. I mean, you're in the car. You probably got a pistol. But the police has got a whole bunch of weapons. And the guy that, you know, he told to put his hands up on the seats winds up getting shot 6 times, twice in the head. They are arrested at 9/11 of all times that night. They make it to the hospital at 11:37. Trying to ride around, let them bleed to death, right? But they don't bleed to death. And in fact, they take them to jail, and they wind up bailing out of jail. How do they bail out of jail? They've got about a $75,000 bail between the three of them. They're poor people. Members of this organization took a vow of poverty. Well, the way they funded their activities was through what they call expropriations. Me and you might call it bank robbery. So they robbed bank after 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 bank. And I keep saying that because they robbed a bunch of banks in a bunch of cities throughout the United States. That's how they funded themselves. I mean, you can't imagine you're going to go to work and make your $2.15 an hour at this point and fund the revolution, right? They decided they were going to go get money from where people kept money, who keep money in banks. And they did not get caught. Here is the windup to this. Just about done here. A person associated with individuals in that car was arrested in New Orleans. It's late on July 3rd. The 4th of July is coming up, and he's been partying. Reuben Scott is from San Francisco.
All right. You've been listening to Curtis Austin, professor, associate professor, Department of History at the University of Oregon, talking about the Black Panther Party. And so I'm going to end it there. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. KPW, LP 97.3 FM, Eugene, Oregon, Peaceworks, independent community radio, also streaming on KPW.org.
Pete on the grip.
Stand by for Northwest Music Mix. I was going to play you some spots here, but that's not coming up. Don't forget, on February 4th, Wednesday, February 4th, at the McNeil Riley House at 7 p.m. is the Industrial Workers of the World movie night on Free Angela and All Political Prisoners, about Angela Davis' incarceration and the move to free her, the movement to free her. Nope. All right, thanks for listening. Tell your friends. Support independent media. It's the only place you're going to find the truth. Well, that's not working either. So, it's also entertaining to listen to non-perfection here. Don't forget, Sundays we have Dr. Zoom, the Dr. Zoom program at 5 o'clock. He plays some wacky music, and I think it's 9 o'clock on Wednesdays. Is a great, we have a great jazz blues show. So be sure and check that out on KPW LP 97.3, Eugene, Oregon, Peaceworks Independent Community Radio. Also online at kpw.org.